you. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about work that has occupied me for a while, for about 2 years, and I'm glad that David is here because after David's comments in the group discussion 2 days ago, I was greatly relieved that I chose to speak about a topic that has absolutely no data analysis in it. But the downshot for some people here might be that we point out an interesting puzzle in vision. It could be that the solution that we propose is not what the brain does. So let me say what I would see as success of this theory. I would see a success is if an experimentalist acknowledges it or thinks too that there's an interesting puzzle and goes and does the experiments, which could be electrophysiology or psychophysics. And I think that even if the experiments don't support the model that I'm going to propose in the first half of the talk, they're going to reveal something interesting about the visual system and about the brain. So let me just put this first into a somewhat more general context. When we think about sensory inference, there are sort of two reasons why we often think that the problem is difficult. I don't know how to define them precisely, but I think you will agree that these are two different aspects of the problem. One is that there is noise, and the noise can come from the physics of how the signal arrives at our sensory organs, and it can come from signal transduction in our sensory organs, and we tend to think about it as something that is more or less additive. And the other reason is that often the objects that we're interested in are subject to all sorts of transformations that we really don't care about. When we hear something, when we hear a word uttered, it can be pronounced quickly or slowly, or in vision, an object can be in various positions, and it can be rotated, and so on. So this is sometimes called, in the statistical inference context, nuisance parameters or confounding signals. And I hope to convince you that in foveal vision, right at the center of our visual system, there is a problem of this type, and the signal is not only subjected to a static transformation, it's subjected to a highly dynamic transformation, and that comes from eye motion. So this is a measurement of eye motions in a human subject, and the human subject is fixating. So he or she thinks that they're looking at the very same position. And nevertheless, you can see that the eyes are moving. You can see that there are sometimes abrupt motions in both eyes that you can see here and here. While fixating, these occur every few hundred milliseconds, and they're similar to saccades. But they're just much smaller, and their size is typically of about 10 minutes of arc, so 1/6 of a degree. But between the microsaccades, you see that there's also motion, and it's kind of a continuous motion. It's different in the two eyes, and it spans between the microsaccades about the same range of 10, 15 minutes of arc. It's somewhat correlated, but it's not perfectly correlated. It's largely uncorrelated.
And you know how much, so as you such a great version, you know how much distance what this
car costs to? That's a good question. I would need to think about it and try to make, I didn't try to estimate that. It's a good question. I'll mention that in a moment. Okay, so the question is this motion large or small? So in the context of peripheral vision, it's very small. But my point is that in the context of foveal vision, it's actually very large, and there are several ways to think about it. So so this is the just a picture of the cone, the photoreceptor array. In the fovea, there is a one-to-one correspondence between the photoreceptors and ganglion cells, and the receptive field is about half a minute of arc. Okay, so it's much smaller than the 10 minutes of arc of motion. Furthermore, in many situations, the features that we can resolve are not surprisingly of the same order of magnitude. So for example, if you go to an eye doctor's office and you look at an eye chart, the smallest letters that you can resolve if you have perfect vision span 5 minutes of arc, okay? So the features that you can resolve, such as the difference between this F and P, are in the order of 1 ArcMinute. There are some tasks in which people have a resolution which far exceeds the resolution of a receptive field. I'll talk about one of these tasks in the second part of this talk. These are called hyperacuity tasks. So clearly, the motion is large compared to the resolution, but it's also large compared when you think about important timescales of neuronal processing. So this is what I find the most striking. If you suppose that you have a ganglion cell that's firing at a high rate, 100 hertz, so there are 10 milliseconds between spikes. The motion between subsequent spikes is about 2 to 4 receptive fields. So in a sense, by the time that the ganglion cell sends a second spike, it's already reporting on a different part of the image. Now, we typically also think about neurons as averaging their input over some timescale that can come from biophysical reasons, but also it makes sense that if the output of the retina is noisy, the brain needs to average or accumulate spikes over some time window. So if we take a moderately small time window, 50 milliseconds, the motion over that timescale is just end-to-end is about 10 minutes of arc, or sorry, 10 receptive fields. And there are, of course, many different paths that the eye could take between these two points. So the question that that's the question that I'm going to address today is how can the visual areas downstream of the retina deal with this jitter? Now, one very important question in this context is whether the brain knows what is the trajectory of the eye. So we know that the brain has access to such information coming from efferent copy from the areas that control eye motion and from proprioceptive feedback. However, for all we know, that information is not nearly doesn't nearly have the correct resolution, spatial and temporal, to track the fine drift that I was talking about. In monkeys, there are also experiments where the proprioceptive feedback was lesioned, and nevertheless, they were able to perform high acuity tasks. So what that leaves us is with the conclusion that if the brain needs to know what is the trajectory of the eye, all it has to work with is the spikes that are sent from the retina, and that's the assumption that I'm going to make throughout this talk. So the kind of questions that I want to address is, how hard actually is the problem? How hard does the motion make visual inference? What kind of computation is needed to infer the context of the image, given that you have this jitter? And roughly speaking, can neurons do it? Are there neural architectures that can support these calculations? Well, I'm going to approximate it as if it's a random walk, which is not precise. So the spectral content is kind of what you'd expect more or less from a random walk. But then there is a. I don't think you need to do that. So it's something like this. So there's a bump. I don't remember exactly where it is. Maybe somewhere between 100 and 200 hertz, which people talk about that part of the motion as not jitter, tremor. Thank you. But yeah, okay. Okay. Oh.
Yeah. So I think the spectral fits very well.
Well, I mean, visual.
I mean,
there's a question
over here. Self motion for motion of the world.
Yeah, so I mean that's a good question. I don't know exactly what is the power spectrum in time of natural images. I'm going to assume in this talk that the image is completely static, which is the case when you're doing a very high acuity task. You're really trying to fixate and stabilize, I mean, with, as much as you can. But then your eyes are moving, and that's the source for the dynamics. What is the question? I don't think that that has been characterized very well. I mean, that's what I'm going to assume, that stationary meaning that within the time scale of the 300 milliseconds between microsaccades, say, the statistics is the same just after the microsaccade and later on. Good question. And I mean, yeah, I don't know of data that answers this question. That's also unknown. The answer to that is not clear. You're saying that it's an experimental error? Okay, so we'll get to that much later in the talk. I mean, there are different types of questions. I mean, biologically, what is causing this motion? Is it muscle noise, or is it something controlled? And another question is, why would this visual system evolve to have that motion? But I prefer to talk about that later. Right, but the belief is that in the fovea, the central fovea, these are similar. Well, I mean, the second slide doesn't have that much content. It's just an overview of what I'm going to talk about. So, well, yeah, but that's not doesn't have anything to do with our work. But anyway, I mean, this is good timing because the first part of the talk is just come out yesterday in PNAS. It's going to be about the question that I'm going to address is what happens, or how can you deal with this problem when the images that you're looking at are coming from a very large unconstrained ensemble, which is what happens typically in vision. The second part of the talk is going to be concerned with a very specific task, which is a hyperacuity task, the vernier task. Those of you who are fortunate enough to have been here for a long time since the beginning of the program might have heard Eran Mukamel talk about that problem too. We're working on this problem together. But even those of you who heard it, I think, I mean, I'm going to present it from a somewhat different angle, and I hope you'll find it interesting nevertheless. So let me just show you that your eyes are moving. This is a nice illusion that demonstrates that. So what you're supposed to do, you see that there are two points here. I'll ask you to fixate on one of them, say on this one, and then after some time to switch to the other one. So just start fixating on this one for about 10 seconds. So don't move your eyes and just continue to look at it constantly. And now switch to the other one and fixate on it. Did this work? So if it worked, what you were supposed to see when you switched, you were supposed to see the normal image, but overlaid on it an after image of white squares, and the white squares were moving. So the interpretation of this is that while you were fixating the first time, there's an after image that was burnt on your retina. And then when you were fixating on the other point, the after image was moving with the retina. So it was moving relative to the real world, and that's what you saw. Okay, so let me start with the first topic. And here's the model that we came up with to start thinking about this question. So we assume that there is a stimulus, and the stimulus is an array of m by m pixels, which I'll assume are binary to make life simpler. And these pixels are projecting to a retina, which I'm modeling also as an array, square array to simplify things. of retinal ganglion cells, and I'm going to assume that there's a one-to-one correspondence. So the pixels have a size of half a minute of arc, and they're projecting to ganglion cells with the same size of receptive field. And then I need to specify a model for how the retina responds and how the retina moves. So for the eye motion, I'm going to assume that it's a random walk. That's not a precise, that it's not precisely true from what we see in measurements, but it's reasonably okay. And then for the ganglion cell firing, I'm going to assume at first a very simple model. I'm going to assume that the ganglion cells are firing as Poisson processes with an inhomogeneous rate in time that depends on what they're seeing at any given time. So if a ganglion cell sees an off pixel, it fires at some rate lambda naught, background rate, that's noise. And if it's seeing an on pixel, it's firing at a higher rate. And I'm going to pick the parameters. Yeah, so x is the current would be the current position of the eye, and that's what's shifting the, that's causing the shift in what the ganglion cell responds to, of the cell. I is a label of the ganglion cell. All right, so just in terms of parameters, the typical parameters that I'm going to think about are diffusion coefficient 100 arc minutes squared per second. That's coming from looking at measurements of eye trajectories. And the firing rates are going to be 10 hertz, which is the background, more or less the background firing rate of ganglion cells in macaque retina. It's pretty high. And the on rate is going to be 100 hertz. All right, so, and then of course, all this model retina is generating spikes. So the question is, suppose that you're a decoder downstream, how can you infer the, what should you do to infer the structure of the stimulus, which I'm assuming is completely static. So the only dynamics in the problem is coming from the fact that the eye is moving. All right, so once I laid out the statistical properties of the model, it's very straightforward to write down what an ideal decoder should do. And with the ingredients that I mentioned, the response of the retina is a Markovian process. So what the decoder should do at any given time is track the posterior probability for any given image S and any given current position of the eye based on all the spikes that it has seen up to time t. And to update that quantity, what you need to do is observe spikes over some time interval delta t, and then update it based on the probability to observe the spikes that you see in this time window given this S and given X. And then what enters also here is the transition probabilities of the diffusion coefficient and the probability distribution at time t. Okay? So then you can formally take the limit of delta t going to 0 and obtain equations in continuous time, update rules between spikes, and an update rule whenever you see a spike. All this is pretty straightforward. And it leads to equations that are sometimes called, in filtering theory, I mean, it's a particular case of what's sometimes called as Zakai equations. So it's straightforward. But the only problem is that to do this, you would need to keep track of this quantity. Okay? Now, this is a very high dimensional quantity. So let me explain why. So a very similar framework was introduced a few years ago by Zach Pitkov and some of my collaborators in the context of a discrimination task. So there the problem was to discriminate between a small vertical bar and a small horizontal bar. And then you could imagine that, and then if you would want to implement this ideal decoder, the number of probabilities that you would need to track is n, which is n being the number of possible positions. So the number of values of x times 2, because you have two stimuli. Okay? So they pointed out very nicely that for that particular task, you can imagine a neural network architecture that would support that calculation. However, in the context that I'm talking about now, if you have, say, 30 by 30 pixels, then the number of possible images is 2 to the 900. Okay? So there's absolutely no way that you could literally implement the calculation that I talked about. Okay, so here's the essence of what we propose in this work, and the rest is going to be just evaluating how well this proposal can do. what we propose is an approximate calculation where you approximate this joint probability for the image and the position by a very restricted form, which is somewhat similar to a mean field approximation in statistical physics, where we restrict it to have a factorial form, a product over of a probability position distribution over positions and probabilities over all pixels. So we're completely neglecting all correlations within this posterior. And you can wonder whether anything good will come out of it. But if we want to update these quantities, here's how we do this. So the idea is as follows. You have at time t this probability distribution. You observe some spikes, and you update it. You update the posterior based on the rule that I showed you previously. But that, in general, generates something which is no longer has this factorial form. And so you recast it into the factorial form. And you can think about this step as minimizing the Kullback-Leibler divergence between the new factorial form and the updated posterior. But in practice, it's just a marginalization. Okay. So doing this, now again, you take the limit of small delta t, and you can mathematically derive update rules between spikes, update rule about when you observe a spike. I'm going to tell you in a moment how they look like. But what we've gained from doing this is that now the number of quantities that we need to track has been dramatically reduced, and it's linear in the number of spikes and linear in the number of positions. Okay, so, and I'm going to think, and we can imagine now that these quantities, the probability distribution over position and probability distribution over pixels, are something which is represented in neurons. And from here on, I'm going to use that language. I'm going to talk about these guys as where neurons that represent where the image is, and these as what neurons that represent what the pixels are. One thing that I want to emphasize is that the pixels here are the pixels in the static image. So this is in the coordinate frame of the world. So if all this works, we're going to end up with a representation here which has somehow compensated for the motion of the eyes and stabilized the image. Okay. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about how the update rules look like. I won't get into all the details. So first, the update rules for the what neurons that represent the identity of pixels. Between spikes, what we find is that their value is decaying. This makes sense. You're not observing spikes, or you have higher probability for the off pixel. And whenever a ganglion cell at position Y fires, there is an update to many of the what neurons. The update involves some nonlinearity. But what's more important is that it involves the activity of a particular where cell. And that's the cell that represents the likelihood, the estimated likelihood that ganglion cell Y is currently aligned with pixel I. So it's the ganglion cell at position that represents position, a shift of Y minus I. Yes. Yeah, so I imagine that this is somehow represented in a firing rate, probably not just of one neuron, but actually a group of neurons, because you probably can, to represent this probability reliably, you probably need more than one neuron. But it's a very fair and important question. We didn't. Well, you're observing just one image at any given time, and you have a whole set of cells, each one representing the estimate of different pixels. Okay? For each pixel, there is a cell, or maybe a group of cells, whose firing rate represents the current estimate of the probability. Does this make sense? And then there's another set of cells whose firing represents the current estimate that your eye is at any given position. For every possible position, yes, Sophie. So Y is just the label position of ganglions, the ganglion cell that has just fired. No, I'll talk about it later, but I don't imagine that this computation is done in the retina. I imagine that this computation is downstream of the retina.
Are you going back to the
So this is a ganglion cell that has fired, and this is the update to a particular ganglion cell that represents the pixel at position I. Yes. Y is, oh, sorry, I is a pixel. Yeah, thanks. I is a pixel that I'm updating. So this is a ganglion cell Y has fired, and this is an update to the estimate of the identity of a pixel. Yeah. The ganglion cells are the input. So if I go back to this drawing, the Ys are here in the retina. But I'm talking about the eyes and the X's are all downstream of the retina, somewhere probably in the visual cortex. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so because we're imagining that the images are binary, it's actually just one. Yeah, precisely. That's precisely true. I never got so many questions about the equations when I presented it. All right, so but that's good. So so beyond the details of the, so these update rules can be interpreted as accumulating evidence about the nature of each pixel. But beyond their details, they tell us something about the architecture of a network that would implement such a computation. What it tells us is that every ganglion cell projects to many of these watt cells. And the projection from ganglion cell Y to watt cell I is gated in a multiplicative manner. That's what you see here by the activity of a particular wear cell. Now, if you look at the update rules for the wear neurons, the details are quite different. So between spikes, the dynamics are diffusive. That reflects the fact that between spikes, you have no information about what the retina is. And the statistics is a random walk, so you're just making your probability distribution broader. And whenever ganglion cell Y fires, there is now an update to many wear cells. And in similarity to what I showed you previously, the update to wear cell X involves the activity of watt cell at position Y minus X. And this update rule, there's a way to interpret it. I won't show you the details, but if you imagine that diffusion is that you have many ganglion cells, so there you receive many spikes in a small interval in which you can neglect the diffusion, if you would apply many of these update rules together, you can interpret them as correlating the spikes that are coming from the retina with your current estimate of what the image is to estimate where the retina is. All right, so in terms of architecture, it's similar to what I showed you before. There's projection to many wear cells and this multiplicative gating from the watt cells. So just to recapitulate what I told you about the architecture, each ganglion cell would need to project to many watt and wear cells, and that's what you see here. And then there is this reciprocal gating between the two populations.
Ralph,
yes.
Like
well, I'm not concerned with the microsaccades. I'm concerned with what's happening between the microsaccades.
So there's
well, there is a fixation. That's, I mean, the all this is happening during fixation. But during fixation, your eyes are actually moving. And again, I mean, it's very small compared to the size of your whole visual scene. But compared to your fovea and the features that you can see in the fovea, it's a large motion. I mean, the extent of the motion is smaller than your fovea, but it's very large compared to the features that you can discriminate. So my answer is that that's precisely what the Bayesian approach is doing. It's tracking the image, as you're going to see, And I think the Bayesian approach just tells you how to do that correctly. I mean, what's the statistical weight that you need to give to the spikes to implement that tracking? Well, I mean, so there is a question whether you could use motion, I mean, ganglion, I mean, here I'm assuming a particular model of the retina where spikes convey information about the nature of the pixel. It's true that the retina has also ganglion cells that report on velocity. These are more peripheral cells, than they're not in the fovea, and the receptive field is probably relatively large. We don't know how accurately they report on the velocity. And then you'd have to, I mean, if you would want to use that, you would need to accurately integrate that quantity. So that's another possibility. I think it's an interesting possibility. I think that in a sense, I mean, if you assume that the retina response is what I described, then this algorithm is estimating, in a sense, the velocity. It's estimating the shift of the eyes based on the spikes, and I think you'll see that, I mean, that's precisely what it's doing. Well, yeah, we don't know. Well, so first of all, I'm really talking right only about the fovea. And in the fovea, as far as I understand, there is not a very large, you know, there's not this whole large set of different ganglion cells. There are basically two types of ganglion cells, and I'm thinking about one of them, but well, it's basically on and off. Right. I mean, yeah, it's a good point that in principle, wear cells, you can imagine that the information about the motion is also gathered from areas outside the fovea. It will be coarser because receptive fields are coarser. On the other hand, there are many cells, so maybe that could be helpful. All right, so just to give you an idea about how this model works, I'll show you a short demo. Okay, so before I run it, let me explain what you're going to see. So this would be just a stimulus, a fixed stimulus that we pick. This would be the photoreceptor response, which is going to be shifting because of the eye motion, ganglion cell response. And what you're going to see here is the activity in what I call the Watt cells, which is the estimation of the stimulus. Here, the activity in the wear cells, where the grayscale represents the probability estimate of where the image is, and these blue, these red circles represent are the actual true trajectory. So let me just run this. So I would suggest to look first here at the wear cells, and you see that there is an estimate which is at first pretty coarse, and then as the estimate of the image becomes better, also the estimate of the position becomes sharper because it's easier for the decoder to track the position. The red is the true trajectory of the image, and the white is the current estimate, and I think there's a shift here which I should have compensated for. I mean, in principle, everything, the problem is defined up to a constant shift anyway. Now, but one thing to observe is that due to both the noisiness and the motion of the eye, if you just look at the ganglion cells, it's very difficult to see any structure in their firing. Another thing is that, I mean, after about 200 milliseconds, in this case, the decoder estimates correctly basically all of the pixels. So the position estimation in words, I would say, is taking into account two elements. One is the statistical property of the diffusion. Okay, so the fact that if you were here at a certain time, it's more likely that you will be close by after a second time. The other is basically a comparison between the spikes that you're observing from the retina and your current estimate of what the image is. You're correlating these two, and that, right, so it's a correlation in a sense between that and that. And initially you don't know anything. No, you're not. You're not bound to converge. I'll talk about that. Yes, Adrian? So I don't think that there's such a diversity in the fovea. But on the other hand, of course, I mean, the question of what happens if you make the ganglion cell model more realistic is an important question. I'll touch on it a little bit later. Yes? Yeah. Two answers to this question. One, I mean, the fact that we're using periodic is just a very technical reason. I mean, we could have done it on a larger area. It would just be more complicated to implement it. And then you would think, if you were still modeling it as a random walk, you could wander off indefinitely. However, there are two reasons why you're not wandering off indefinitely. One is that the time is not infinite. We're talking about 300 milliseconds, basically, between microseconds. The second, which we're not taking into account in the model, is that if you look at the statistics of eye motion, so you plot delta x square as a function of time. So if this was a random walk, you'd expect, suppose that this is a log-log plot, so you'd expect to see a line of slope 1. What you truly see is at small times something with a higher slope. So that suggests that there's some ballistic element to the motion. But then after some time scale, the slope is smaller than 1. And this probably has to do with the fact that there's a tendency to go back to the center. Okay. Right. You can ask how. Right. I mean, we haven't done it, but it's something that you can do, and you can also, even within the context of the model, just random walking, you can ask how robust it is to change to an incorrect estimate of the diffusion coefficient. Which one? Yes. You should think about it as the estimate of the shift of the eye relative to the position at time 0, which was the last microsecond. Oh, so I think the relevant thing to think about is the more or less the range of motion between microseconds, which would be in the order of 10 minutes of arc. So it's about 20 receptive fields in each direction. That's what you would need. It's an interesting question. I mean, my tendency is to think that in the central fovea, you're anyway looking at the fovea is looking at such a small area that maybe the 3D dimension is not so important. On the other hand, for the whole visual field, it probably is. I haven't thought deeply about that question, and it's an interesting.
I mean,
it's a good comment. All right, so let me talk a little bit about how performance of this whole thing depends on the parameters. So I'll show several plots like this. What I'm showing is this is a diffusion coefficient. This is convergence time, which I'm thinking as the time that it takes to correctly estimate 90% of the pixels. This would this accuracy percentage of correct pixels at a certain time, 300 milliseconds. And if you look first at the black line, you see that performance becomes worse as you increase the diffusion coefficient. The problem is more difficult, both in terms of the convergence and the accuracy. The other thing is that this should be clear. If you make the firing rate higher, the problem becomes easier. And there's you can really think about this just in terms of dimensional analysis. Doubling the firing rate has the same effect as making the diffusion coefficient 2 times smaller and scaling also time by a factor of 2. So if we assume that the rate of spikes on the retina is doubled, you get better performance. What is more interesting is to us is that there is a strong dependence of the performance on the number of pixels in the image. So what you see here are performances of the same algorithm where you have 5 by 5, 10 by 10, up to 40 by 40 pixels, or 10 by 10, sorry, arc minutes, and which is 10 by 10 up to 80 by 80 pixels. And you see that when you increase the number of pixels, performance improves. The convergence time goes down. The accuracy goes up. Or another way to think about it is that the decoder can cope with larger magnitude of motion before performance starts to degrade. And the reason that this is happening is that for larger images, you have more information about where the eye is. So the tracking becomes better. And if you look at the activity in the what I call the wear cells, you see that the tracking is sharper the larger the image is. Another point. So now there's one value of the diffusion coefficient, which is measured in humans. It's about 100 arc minutes squared per second. So you see that you get here good performance for images whose size is about 20 by 20 arc minutes or larger. Another point that I'd like to make is that performance is very sensitive to the coarseness of the features that you want to extract. So imagine that you have pixels whose size is, instead of half an arc minute, 1 by 1 arc minute. Then each pixel, then effectively the diffusion on the scale of the pixel size is 4 times smaller. And in addition, you have 4 ganglion cells to report on each pixel. So that would cause a dramatic improvement. So here you see a result for a 5 by 5 arc minute image if you assume that the features you're trying to extract are 1 arc minute in size. And then you get good performance also for the biological value of the diffusion coefficient. But the dependence on image size, we think, it generates an interesting prediction for psychophysics, because what it tells you is that if you have a very small image on the fovea, inference will be difficult. OK, that's not surprising. But if you add more features which are peripheral to that image, and they can be just constant and independent of the task that you're trying to do, they could help, because they will provide more information about where the eye is. But you'd have to do the experiment in such a way that the only features in your visual scene are the stimulus, which is different from what is typically done, where you have a monitor, you can see the boundaries of the monitor, and there are other features in the visual scene that could provide that type of information. How would that show whether the eye, I mean, I think that that would give you less direct evidence for the fact that the eye is using the information in the visual scene peripheral to your task to I think that you can do that, yes. I think that you can do that. And let me say what is, I think, the most important aspect of this theory that this would address. It would address the assumption that we made that the brain has no access to information about the diffusion. Because if you add some diffusion which is of the same order of magnitude as the motion of the eyes, you'd expect still not to see a strong degradation in performance, right? In that case, even better would be to cancel and add motion which has, yeah. So this has been done. Actually, there's a paper that came out this year from Michele Rucci's lab, where they show that for perception of motion, it really works that way. You can cancel the true eye jitter and introduce some global motion of the image, and that has no effect on how well you can perceive whether an object is moving or not. Okay, but that might be a somewhat different question than the question of discrimination between high resolution features. So I hope that they're going to do that experiment as well. Okay, now one worry that you might have is that perhaps the task that we're requiring is very artificial and it's very different. It's very hard. And I think it's actually true that if you would show a human subject an array of binary pixels, each having half a minute of arc in size, or even 1 minute arc minute of 1 minute of arc in size, you won't be able to report on the value of each pixel. So we were interested to see how well this algorithm performs on a task which is performed every day, millions of times probably in the world, which is the eye chart test. And so we take patterns, which are 26 patterns, which correspond to the letters of the alphabet, each one spanning 5 minutes of arc. We present that to this factorized decoder. The decoder generates an estimate for each pixel, and then we use that to generate a likelihood for each one of the patterns, and do maximum likelihood choice. And this, what you see here, is the fraction of correctly classified pixels as a function of time. And after about 300 milliseconds, you're getting more than 90% of them correct. Just to give you an idea, if you look at the accumulated spikes over a time window of 50 milliseconds, this is typically how they look like. They really look like a blob. It's very difficult to, I mean, I wouldn't be able to guess which letter it is. Think it's an O? Maybe. Okay, so there are some other questions that we addressed, and I'll see how, I mean, I think I'll actually go fairly quickly on this because I want to go to have time to talk about the second project. But one aspect is that we have some understanding of how performance scales with image size. I think that's interesting mathematically, but I mean, the main result is just that it scales with very strongly with image size, and the details are perhaps not that important, although they are interesting. And the other aspect is the fact that the response of ganglion cells actually is not instantaneous and involves a temporal filter. So by the way, when I showed you these results, these were generated when we actually include the temporal filter in the response of ganglion cells. So that's a very difficult problem. So I'm going to skip the scaling part. Temporal response of ganglion cells. So why is this a problem? It's a problem for us, we can think about it in more than one way, but first of all, just define the problem. So I assume so far that the response is instantaneously, but more realistically, a more realistic model would be that a ganglion cell convolves the input that it sees with some temporal kernel, and then applies some nonlinearity, and that sets the firing rate. And the kernel typically has this structure. It's biphasic, and it spans about 100 milliseconds. Okay, the on part, the excitatory part, is in the order of 40 milliseconds. So, so conceptually, this becomes difficult because we now have a new timescale in the problem, say 50 milliseconds. Ganglion cell is averaging what it's seen at that time, but there has been a lot of motion, and what it has seen at that time depends on the particular trajectory, which pixels happened to align with the receptive field, and that's trajectory dependent. Mathematically, the problem becomes much more difficult because the spike generation problem process is non-Markovian. So in principle, even if you would want to formulate the ideal decoder, it would need to keep track not only of the current position, but the history of the trajectory in the past 100 milliseconds or so. So Yeah, but I mean, ganglion cells can fire at the rate of 100 hertz, or even a little bit more than that. But and furthermore, I don't care about the spike. Right, but you're right. But the question whether they're firing on or not depends on what their stimulus was in the past 100. Well, I think that firing time. Well, I think it would just make it even more complicated. But in addition to having spike history, which just makes things more complicated, there is in these models. I mean, you always find that there's a temporal kernel applied to the stimulus itself. Right. So actually, I don't think we know what are the temporal kernels precisely at the center of the fovea. That's one of the problems which I'm going to mention, that nobody really knows at any level what's happening in the central fovea. The best, the most close that you know is 3 degrees or 2 degrees from the fovea. And there, the receptive fields are already larger, and the whole question of stabilization is not so important. But this is just taken by what you see, say, in the periphery of the fovea. Yeah. All right, so I won't say that much about this. I mean, one thing that we've done is to just take the naive decoder that ignores all this and see how well it performs. And the main take-home message is that if the features that you're trying to extract are 1 arcminute in size, then you're still doing reasonably well. We have some ideas on how to improve on it, but you get some improvement from that. It's not dramatic, but it's significant. But there's one topic that I do want to just mention, talk about a little bit, and that is the question of whether fixational motion is beneficial. Why do we have this jitter? So, and you'll see why that's related to the temporal filter in a moment. So, a common view that people will mention is that fixational motion is important because our eyes stop responding if you see a static image. So if you flash a new image on the eyes and it's completely static, there will be a transient response, and then the eyes will just stop responding. So it seems that it makes sense that introducing some dynamics might be useful. That's not contradictory to, now there are several reasons why that's happening on various timescales, but the most basic reason is on the shorter timescales is that it's just this biphasic filter. So imagine that this filter is precisely balanced, that the excitatory part and the inhibitory part are the same in magnitude, then this model retina would stop responding after 100 milliseconds. So this idea is not contradictory with our model. If we include such a filter, it would probably be beneficial to have some motion. And in fact, that's what we see. So solving the problem, the full problem exactly, when you have an unknown trajectory and a temporal filter is a very difficult problem mathematically. We don't know how to solve it exactly. But what we can say is what would be the performance of an ideal decoder that actually knows what the trajectory is. Okay? Suppose that it has perfect knowledge of the trajectory. And what we typically see is what you see here, that if you ask what the convergence time is as a function of the diffusion coefficient, it goes down. So there is a benefit of having diffusion, and then there is some ideal optimal value beyond which the problem becomes harder. The interesting thing is that the optimal value that we find is more than an order of magnitude smaller than the biological value. Okay, so within the analysis that we're doing, I cannot say the analysis cannot support the idea that magnitude, the magnitude of fixational motion that humans have, is beneficial. That doesn't mean that it's not beneficial, because we're looking at a very specific type of task, which is identification of very high resolution features. And maybe for more peripheral vision or more coarse features, a higher value of the diffusion coefficient would be more beneficial. But I just want to stress also that this is, in a sense, an overestimate of the optimal diffusion coefficient, because we assume that the trajectory is known. If you don't know the trajectory, you would expect that to infer it would be more difficult the higher the diffusion coefficient, so it would shift the minimum to the left. And also, I assumed here in this analysis that this filter is perfectly balanced, and in reality, it's not. Right. Yeah. Okay, so if you just take the shape of the filter and scale time, it's pretty straightforward to, I think, to understand how it will change. But for other shapes of filters, I haven't tried it. I didn't, you know, try to explore this, and I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know what the answer is. But I suspect that any filter that averages the spikes over a time which is large compared to over which you have a large motion would cause difficulties. Yeah, it's pretty flat. It's true. Yeah, I need to think about it. Maybe you're right, but I suspect that for coarser features, just from scaling, because D has dimensions also of length squared, I suspect that if the features are coarser. I see. Perhaps. Okay. I really want to talk about the second project as well, so I'm going to go very quickly. I mean, I'll just skip part of the discussion that I had here, which was concerned with where in the brain could this be, and what are the implications for the implementation on the brain. Oh, yeah. Well, now it's a black. What it was red in previous slides. Yes.
Is that like an FPT turning on and off?
Yes, exactly. It's a multiplicative gating. And so I just wrote down what are the computation. I mean, it's very nice to talk about the neural network implementation, but we're really just talking about the architecture. And there are all sorts of computations that you need to do, which I don't know how a neuron would implement them. There are two elements in particular. One is this gating, and it's not only gating. It has to be fast, dynamic gating. And the other one is that there are also these particular nonlinearities in the equations that you need to somehow implement. Okay. Now, let me just say in terms of what does this say about activity? I think the most important prediction is that you'd have neurons in the visual system that represent the image stabilized in the coordinate frame of the world rather than the coordinate frame of the moving eye. And then the dynamics of these neurons would somehow reflect accumulation of evidence. So where in the brain could this be? I would rule out LGN because of the large divergence from any ganglion cell to all these where and what cells. And we don't see that, at least in peripheral regions of LGN. I mean parafoveal regions. So then the next natural place to think about is the early visual cortex. And Right. So the question is whether you have very intricate connections between the colliculus and cortex, because the part of where you're inferring the image You would imagine that that's in cortex, right? Okay, so this might be. I'll get to that in a moment. Good comment. I don't think that's very, very strongly because, I mean, you have less information, but you still have the same type of problem and the same solution. So I don't, I mean, maybe if you project, I mean, there's a question, what happens if you have a different trajectory in the two eyes? But since in any case, the two eyes have a different trajectory, which I'll talk about in a second, in a moment. I'm not sure that this generates a strong prediction. Uh-huh. Right. Right, so that's more of a question of amount of information, and you can also play with contrast and, okay, so yeah, maybe, I mean, I'll talk about the two eyes in a moment, and maybe that will answer partly the question. I mean, at least it will, I will present how I imagine that this is done with the two eyes. So now there's a question whether there are stabilized responses in V1, and it's not a new idea. There were experiments in the early 1990s that suggested precisely that, and these were by Motor and Poggio. But then a few years later, there were experiments by another group, group Gurren Snodderly, who claimed the opposite. So it's a somewhat controversial question. I don't think that I'm equipped to judge who is. Is it because of what? Right. So. Yeah, but I mean, so my problem with all these experiments is that they're not really looking at the central fovea. They're looking at parafovea. I think, right. I mean, the interpretation is very difficult. You need to measure very carefully the motion of the eye. So that's what they are doing. Yeah. But in principle, I think so. My feeling about this is that the literature is not yet answering this question, and it's probably, as you say, it's coming from the limitations of measurement in the central fovea. But
small
Well, I mean, I think it's even just a problem of, I think it's even a. Yeah, well, I'm not sure. Right. Right. Well, I think that part of the problem is just the technical measurement of the motion at that accuracy. And well, it's clear that there is still some controversy about this question. Although I do tend to believe more that in V1, in those cells that were measured, in the parafovea, there isn't a stabilization. But I'm not sure about it. I'll be glad to hear your assessment of that in more detail. Now, one other possibility is related to the fact that the eyes are moving differently. So in fact, what would make sense is to have a separate tracking of each one of the eyes. So you should imagine that you have separate wear populations for the left and right eye. And then the information of what being, of the image itself being from both eyes. And that would actually, that kind of architecture would solve two problems at the same time. One is the jitter of the eyes, but also the registry and combining of the information from the two eyes. So that could happen a little bit downstream, in V2 perhaps, in cells that receive monocular input, but whose response is already binocular. All right, so let me summarize this part. I talked about a strategy for stabilization of the foveal image. It's based on a factorized Bayesian approach to the multidimensional inference problem. It involves two populations of cells. What cells represent the image in the stabilized coordinate of the world, where cells represent where the image is. Good performance at the 1 arc-minute resolution, and the problem is easier for larger images, which generates a prediction for psychophysics. And then the network architecture involves these many-to-many inputs from the retina to both populations, and a reciprocal multiplicative gating. Okay. So I'll at least start to talk about the second topic, which is the veneer hyperacuity task. So we think that the veneer hyperacuity task is very interesting to think about for two reasons. One is that there is a lot of psychophysics on it. And the other one is that, as I hope I'll convince you, it's very amenable to mathematical analysis. So, and perhaps the mathematical analysis is going to teach us something. So what is the veneer task? It comes in various versions, but the typical one is that you have two bars. They're pretty short, typically, say, 5 minutes of arc. But then they're also separated horizontally, and the horizontal separation is really tiny. So typical separation would be 5 arc seconds, which is 1/6 of a minute of arc. About one tenth of a minute of arc, and 1/6 of a receptive field in the fovea. Okay, so what should we compare this to? We should compare this to the size of the foveal receptive field. It's much smaller, so that's the typical reason why people think that hyperacuity is surprising. And then the general explanation is that you're accumulating information from many cells, and that helps. But what people didn't think about very carefully is the fact, or almost not at all, is the fact that the eyes are moving a lot while you're doing it. The range of the motion overall between microsaccades is 500 arc seconds, so it's 100 times larger than the magnitude of this separation. And so the questions that we want to address is how difficult the problem really is, given that there is the motion of the eyes, and then what structure of decoder could actually solve the problem. And before I continue, it turns out that there is a Guinness Book World of Record in hyperacuity, and it's held by this gentleman who's called Dennis Levy, and he's actually a scientist working on vision. He has a lab in Berkeley. So I think he does a little bit better than that, probably about 3 arc seconds. Really? For vernier? Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm not sure that the record is actually on this task. Maybe it's on another related. One thing to mention about this task is that the people improve on the, on these tasks over very long timescales. So these are typically the people are highly trained, the subjects. Okay, so here's the model that we're looking at. I mean, as before, I'm going to start at least with a very simple model, and then I'm going to make it more elaborate. So I imagine that there are 2 neural populations responding to, one responding to the upper bar, one responding to the lower bar, and they're separate. And I'm going to assume that the whole stimulus is moving around. The trajectory is called xi of t, and it's a random walk. So the bars are appearing in positions xi plus d and xi minus d. And for reasons that will become apparent in a moment, I'm going to assume that the receptive fields are Gaussians with a standard deviation of sigma, and that they're dense. OK, so why are these assumptions useful? Because if you just think about it a little bit, you realize that if you start from a Gaussian prior on xi and on d, you're going to remain with a Gaussian posterior at any given time. And let me explain why. The reason is that between spikes, because the receptive fields are dense, you're not receiving any information about the position of the bars. So all that happens is a widening of the distribution, posterior distribution on xi. So that's like convolving with a Gaussian. And whenever you observe a spike, you're multiplying your posterior by a function of xi plus d or xi minus d, depending on the population. So both multiplication by a Gaussian and convolving with a Gaussian leave you with a Gaussian. So we can write down explicitly what the posterior looks like, and I'll do that a little bit later. But it's first useful to see what are the dimensionless parameters in the problem. So one of them is the distance between the bars, and you can scale it, say, by the size of the receptive field. So that's a typical quantity that people think of as making the problem difficult. It's small, right? The distance is small compared to the receptive field size. And then there's another parameter that encompasses everything you need to know about the diffusion. Let me explain what it is. So R here is the firing rate from the whole population. And D is a diffusion coefficient. So D over R is the typical distance traveled by the stimulus between subsequent spikes. And that is compared, this distance squared is compared to the size of the receptive field. Yeah. R is mean population firing rate from the whole population. I mean, it's a total, actually. It's not the mean. It's a total. Okay, so if epsilon is large, diffusion is large, we expect the problem to be difficult. If epsilon is very small, we expect diffusion not to play an important role. And I'm going to work from now on in units where I just make everything dimensionless. So I'm working spatially in units where the receptive field size is 1. And I'm going to scale time by R. So the only dimensionless parameter in the problem, these are going to be the only dimensionless parameters in the problem. I mean, they're always the dimensionless. These are going to be the parameters. Now, before I talk about diffusion, it turns out that it's actually very instructive to think about the case where you don't have diffusion. It's all very simple, but instructive nevertheless. So imagine that the stimulus is at position 0, and we know that it's at position 0. How does the ideal estimator look like? Very simple exercise to write it down. And it looks like a sum over all spikes from the plus population, weighted by their position, minus spikes from the minus population. By plus and minus, I'm going to mean the upper and lower. Okay? So you do this sum, you divide by the number of spikes, and that's the best estimate of the separation between the bars. If you don't want to do an estimation of D, but just want to say whether it's positive or negative, you don't care about the denominator. And you see that the numerator is linear in the spikes. It's something that you could implement in a perceptron. OK, it's a linear sum over spikes with some weights. Now, what happens if we were wrong about where the position, about where the stimulus is? So suppose that we are applying this decoder, but Xi is actually drawn from a normal distribution around zero with some standard deviation. You can calculate what is the variance of this decoder. And it turns out that it goes like 1 over time, so it improves as you gather more spikes. But there's a large penalty for the fact that you misestimated the true position. In fact, suppose that the stimulus is placed on with a prior, with a uniform prior, then this decoder is going to fail completely. This is going to diverge. But it's also very straightforward to write down how the decoder looks like if you assume that the position, that Xi, is drawn from a flat prior. It's very the answer is very intuitive. It's the estimate of position of the first bar minus the estimate of position of the second bar. Okay? But now if we want to make a decision, just a discrimination rather than estimate, we can rewrite this as just taking a common denominator. And what is interesting is what you see here is now quadratic in spikes. It's linear in the positions of the spikes, but it's a sum over pairs of spikes, where one spike came from the upper population, one spike came from the lower population, and what you weigh in is the difference in their positions. OK? So this is quadratic in spikes. And this estimator works fine. The variance goes like 1 over time. It goes like 1 over time with a coefficient 1. So this takes me into a short sidetrack, which is related to a work that was, it's already like pretty old now. It's from 93 by Sebastian Sung and Chaim Sompolinski, that many of you are probably familiar with. And what they considered is essentially a very similar problem. They didn't call it a Vernier task. It was a task where you see an oriented bar, and then you see another bar which is either slightly rotated to the right, clockwise or anticlockwise, and you need to say whether it was clockwise or anticlockwise. And so the main difference is that this is defined on a ring rather than being on a line. And they considered a general receptive feed, not just a Gaussian one. And first of all, there's a limit on the performance that you can expect to have for any decoder, which is given by the Fisher information. But what they showed in that paper is that if you know what is the absolute position, you just don't know if, whether it's clockwise or anticlockwise, you can train the perceptron to perform that task, and for large number of spikes, it can saturate the limit given by the Fisher information. But if you don't know where the position is, and if you want to be invariant to any global translation of the stimulus, the perceptron can't perform the task. You train it to do it in these positions, it will completely fail in other positions. So there was another later paper by Matteau and Sompolinski where they looked at some network architectures that can solve the problem, but we, based on just the intuition that we got from the line, with this quadratic decoder, we wondered whether a quadratic decoder could solve the problem. So a general quadratic decision variable, which you compare to zero to decide whether it's clockwise or anticlockwise, would look like this. It's a sum over all spikes, one coming from the first presentation, second coming from the second presentation, and with some weight that depends on the difference in their positions of their receptive fields. And you can think of this weight as a function which you try to optimize for. It's a parameter. And for example, if the receptive field is like a Gaussian on a ring, which is the exponent of alpha times cosine theta, it turns out that the optimal structure of the weight is a sinusoidal. If for other shapes of the receptive field, you get other structures. But what is, yes? I think that in general, I mean, you don't have a very good generalization in humans. But I mentioned this, I'm mentioning all this not because of my interest in that task, but because of the mathematical interest in what is the structure of a decoder that would do this well. So what is interesting also is that we can ask what is the performance of this quadratic decoder. And much to our surprise and delight, what we find is that it actually achieves the theoretical bound given by the Fisher information in some limit. The limit is that you have a large number of spikes, the receptive fields are dense, and the distance between the bars is small. Okay. So what I'm getting at is that this structure of quadratic decoders, the use of quadratic decoders can allow you to perform the task in an invariant manner to static translations, and as you're going to see, that's true also for dynamic translations. So we're going back to eye motion now. And you can ask, one thing that you can ask is, how well do the static decoders do? So the decoders that I presented earlier. So I presented one decoder which assumed that you're at position 0. So suppose you start from position 0, and then but you have dynamic drift. Turns out that the variance of this decoder has a very undesirable property that it doesn't improve with time. Instead, it saturates at epsilon on the scale of the receptive field size. The other decoder that I mentioned that assumes a uniform prior is more resilient to the motion, but it also saturates at epsilon over 3. Okay, so. Yes. Yes. So now, one thing that I forgot to mention is that you estimate what epsilon is for reasonable parameters of a veneer task. It comes out of order 1. Okay. So what this tells you is that these decoders are not going to achieve hyperacuity. They're not going to achieve acuity which is small, very small compared to receptive field. So now let me tell you a little bit about the ideal decoders. As I said, the problem is the posterior is Gaussian, and we can write down how the decoder looks like. And I'll go on as far as we can. I mean, we'd probably need to stop soon. So this is how the estimator looks like. Okay, it looks like a sum over pairs of spikes, where of this quantity. Now, I need to explain what the S's and the X's are. So imagine that you have a vector that's the S with an entry for each spike, plus 1 if it came from the upper population, minus 1 if it came from the lower population. So that's the S's, and the X's are the positions of the receptive fields. Okay. So what you have here in the sum is you have a sum only over pairs of spikes where 1 came from the upper population and 1 came from the lower population. Otherwise, this is 0. And then what you're weighing in is the difference between positions with some weight, and I have to tell you what that weight is. In general, this weight has a somewhat complicated structure that depends on the timings of the spikes. So if you imagine that the spikes are coming as Poisson, this depends on any given realization of the problem. You'll have different timings, and you need to calculate a certain matrix and invert it. But I'll just maybe take three or four more minutes, if that's OK. And talk about one particular simplification of the problem. So imagine that miraculously, the spikes are not coming as Poisson, but are coming in regular intervals. Okay. In that. This is now a separate. This is just the spikes. These are properties of the spikes that the retina has sent to you. Yes, yes. Are the positions of the receptive fields of these ganglion cells. So, okay. So the S just tells you whether it's a ganglion cell from the upper population, from the lower population. The X tells you where that ganglion cell is. So that's an interesting thing. Let's get to that in a moment, OK? That's the ideal decoder. I didn't do any approximation. That's how it turns out to be, OK? So now just think about the case where the spike intervals are regular. So here you have a unit matrix, and it's possible actually to write down what this matrix is and what is its inverse. And then it turns out that up to some boundary effects that I'm ignoring, the matrix Cij is just an exponential function of the time difference between the spikes. So this is a very simple decoder. You're summing up pairs of spikes, one from the upper, one from the lower. You're averaging in the difference in their positions, and you're weighting it by some function of the time difference. Okay? And as you might imagine, that the more diffusion you have, you want to concentrate over pairs of spikes that come at shorter intervals, and that's exactly what happens. So this the time scale here for this coincident spike consideration decreases when you increase the diffusion coefficient. But what I find really striking about this decoder is the following. Previously, in the previous work, I talked about the solution where you're explicitly tracking where the eye is. Here, there's an ideal decoder for that particular problem, and there's no explicit estimate of where the eye is whatsoever. It's just doing this summation over pairs of spikes with some temporal kernel. So all this generalizes also to the...
Yeah,
there is a motion of the eye. And this is the ideal decoder for that problem. I need to stop here. So I'll just mention that all this generalizes also to Poisson spikes. It's a little bit more complicated, but you can consider decoders with this quadratic structure. And they're not perfectly ideal, but they're very close to the ideal decoder. So I'm just going to skip this. And if anyone is interested, I'll be glad to talk about this later. I'll summarize and tell you also some facts that I didn't tell you yet. But one is that the linear, the messages that I'd like to make here are that, first of all, a linear discrimination cannot solve the Vernier task while remaining resilient to static or dynamic translations. And a quadratic decoder, which is quadratic in the spikes, can solve the problem. It saturates the theoretical bounds in some limits. And in other cases, it's pretty close to the theoretical bound. And I didn't talk about implementation, but what comes across from this is that the solution would be it would involve coincident spike detectors that are sensitive to spikes that are occurring within some short time window in two ganglion cells. And just a general concluding statement, I hope that, beyond the specific models that I talked about, I hope that I convince you that there is an interesting challenge to understand related to foveal vision due to the motion of the eyes. And we think that there should be some type of specialized neural processing in foveal areas. So if people will manage to record in the cortex in various layers at the central fovea, I think they'll find something interesting happening there. So let me just acknowledge other people involved in this work. The first work was done also with Uri Rockne, who worked on the first stages of that problem. Both works are done with Markus Meister and Chaim Sompolinski. The second work is done with Eran Mukamel. And generally speaking, discussions with members of the Meister lab were very helpful, and especially Ofer Mazor, who is recording responses of the retina to stimuli that are jittering. And my funding was from the Schwartz Foundation. Yeah, David. No, you actually can. So once you're using a quadratic decoder with a temporal time kernel, whatever you do, almost, you get a variance which goes like 1 over time. So you're improving the longer you're looking at the stimulus. So in principle, any of these decoders will reach any. The static decoders that ignore the motion has this undesired property that they saturate. Okay. It's something alpha over t versus what I got from the static decoders, which was actually when there is motion, it's just not going as 1/t. It saturates. It's epsilon or epsilon over 3. Precisely. I mean, you can imagine there is a very simple arc procedure. That I don't know. If you have, so let me. No, I'm not.
This is a sort representing special objects.
Yeah. Right.
An image is a collection of special objects.
Okay. So let me tell you why I think that it works so well for the Vernier. It looks for so well because the second order statistics are all you need to know. The image, the structure of the image has to do with just two lines. And if you know the second order statistics, it defines what it is.
Yeah.
And delta x.
And then you don't have to use the statistics.
then you can go back to the whole transformation of things to be by philosophy. And the brain does the inverse.
Perhaps. I think that for general images, it's going to be a more complicated question. One question that you can ask is, suppose that you gather these statistics, the spike coincidence statistics. That's a partial statistics about the spikes that you've observed. How well can you make general inference based on these statistics? And we're starting to look at that question. I think that the Vernier task is special in the fact that these second order statistics are somehow a sufficient statistics. They're telling you everything that you need to know. Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Right. That's possible. Yeah. Well, you can imagine, let me answer actually the second question first. So you can imagine that the whole process of vision refreshes, starts anew whenever you do a microsaccade. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that that's not the case. So one, for example, one interesting question is, in the context of this tracking algorithm that I described, maybe you want to use information about the image from the previous saccade in order to have some activity in the watt population that will help you to track once you start the new saccade, right? That's a possibility. A few hundred milliseconds. A few hundred milliseconds. Oh, the second question. I think that there are various types of, there are various ways to try to simplify the approach. I mean, so one way that you mentioned is to parameterize the wear distribution instead of having a cell or describing a probability assigned to each possible position in space, parameterize it as a Gaussian and somehow represent that. And that's I think a valid and interesting way to explore. Okay. Another question is whether you need to track the image at all. Where you need to track the positions of the eye at all. So in the Vernier task, the solution that we got doesn't seem to explicitly do that. It just doesn't do that. And I think that's also an interesting question to explore. Right. I mean, we're not talking here about these experiments where you're tracking objects. The basic observation that your eye moves together. I mean, the whole motion in your eyes is the same everywhere in your eye because it's a motion of your eye. So you can accumulate information from all the cells in your fovea or maybe even peripheral to the fovea to estimate the position of your eye because all of them are moving in the same way. Right. Right. So we're considering here only static objects, and if you have motion in your image, then it becomes more complicated. I'm confused about this too, but I would say that our analysis, with the analysis that we're doing, it seems to point to the fact that diffusion at 100 arc minutes squared per second makes inference in the fovea really hard. And it's surprisingly.
Rapidly responding, feel motor system, and then the consequences of that there's a
I'm puzzled by the system as a whole, because I find it surprising that the visual system would evolve in such a way that it introduces this fast diffusion on the scale of foveal vision, even if it's beneficial, considering that it requires pretty elaborate circuitry downstream to make sense of what the retina is sending to the brain. Okay, so. Yeah, why is it moving so much? Why isn't it moving less? Yeah, so I don't think that the analysis supports that that hypothesis quantitatively. It qualitatively it does. Right. So that's interesting to look at. I mean, the problem is that once you assume a more complicated model of neural response, we don't know really what is the ideal structure of the decoder. But we can, within the framework of the quadratic decoder, we can answer that question: what is the ideal form, and then what is the performance? Okay. So that's So that would be I think an interesting question. Yeah. Then we're happy. Then we're all happy.